This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Writing a novel is a daunting piece of business. But for James Wood, there's an extra dimension to it all. Wood has been a literary critic at this magazine for a decade, and before that, at The New Republic and The Guardian. As a critic, he's alive to the infinite ways in which a book can go right or go flat. He's attuned to every detail of voice, point of view, and structure. But more than that, James has a certain reputation. He's exacting. Sometimes, when necessary, he's even been a little bit ruthless, some would say. He believes in the need for deep cultural argument, and if he makes an enemy along the way sometimes, so be it. The stakes are high, in other words. Maybe that's why it's been 15 years between James Wood's first novel and the new one. The book is called Upstate, and it's set in Saratoga Springs, New York, and it follows a father, an Englishman, spending time with his adult daughters, one of them an energetic corporate executive, the other a melancholy professor of philosophy. It's a meditation on what it means to be a parent and what it means to be a family.
Your critical sensitivity is incredibly acute. I mean, one of your great talents as a critic is to give a reading of a paragraph, of a passage, and break it down the way a musician would, the way a musician would go into 16 bars of music and take it apart and see what it's doing and how it's working, where it's mistaken, and all the rest. How do you go about your fictional life? You teach at Harvard. You, thank God, write essays for us. You do other things. You're easily the world's greatest drummer who also writes novels and literary criticism.
Hello, Bob, perhaps.
Well, yeah, but I must say, damn good. No kidding around. But how does fiction work in your day-to-day work life? Is it an event or is it the everyday thing?
No, it was definitely an event, and I think that's an explanation for why it's been 15 years since I last wrote a novel. It's an event that has to fit into making a living, being a parent, teaching, writing criticism. It's not to say that I didn't make a daily space for it. I tried to make a daily space for it, but the novel took me a long time because I would stop for months on end, actually, when there was, say, a big piece to write or when term time just got too much of a hassle. I would just sort of stop and say, okay, I don't do it until the summer. But that didn't bother me too much, actually, because of this mental image that was always going on, which was that...
What's the mental image?
The mental image was that... even when I wasn't writing it, I was writing it. The mental image was that every single piece I wrote for the magazine or book I taught to the students at Harvard, however sort of irksome or ordinary, seemed to be teaching me something. I've always felt that, actually.
Now, this book, I would think, comes in large measure out of the death of your mother. The event of it, the image of it, the desire to write about it in some ways. Can you tell me a little bit about how that works? In other words, the event in life and then how it starts developing into a work of art in your mind.
Yeah, my mother died in 2014. And as happens when a parent dies, you reflect on a whole life, but you also reflect on quality of parenting that made you who you are. My mother was a very complicated creature, and I have to say that I feel as a lucky middle child that I got the best of it. That's to say, when I wrote a piece for the magazine about my mum, my sister who read it was in furious disagreement because her idea of my mother was of a much more hostile, much more abusive, much angrier person than mine. But where my sister and I would agree is that my mother was a depressive. And her mother, my grandmother, had some sort of nervous breakdown in the 20s or 30s, and I actually allude to this in the novel, and had electroconvulsive therapy. So when my mother died, I was naturally reflecting on a certain legacy of happiness and unhappiness in our family that flowed from her. And then when you add to that one's own experience as a parent, how little one can actually control, it turns out, in the lives of one's children, and the awful thought that happiness might be one of those things one can't materially affect very much, that much more is determined perhaps by, you know, DNA or by birth order or by the vagaries of personality and temperament than anything one can actually do as a parent. So that was really what was really the germ of this novel, was thinking about the apparently arbitrary distribution of happiness and unhappiness in families.
At one point in your novel, your main character, Alan, says the following, that extraordinary power family had to blot out all other considerations, all other desires and dissatisfactions. Perhaps he'd feared that, recognized its engrossing fanaticism. If you surrender to that, you would do nothing else in life, build nothing else. How have you experienced that tension?
That's pretty much me speaking right out.
I'd guess that.
I'll put it this way. I now understand, and have done for a few years, why traditionally female writers were so wary of having children and why canonically so many didn't. There's no doubt that it is a rival engrossment to, say, the writing life.
That men opt out of, or?
I mean, traditionally, I think men did, and they don't now, which is why you're getting actually some writing by men at last about fatherhood, whether it's Knausgård or Chabon or whatever. And it's not surprising. I mean, it's not just that it's rival creation and rival creativity. It's also, of course, the fact that having a child presents you with a limited and a feasible set of projects and goals, and you know, things that, do you know what I mean? It's dullish, but very easy for me to drive my son to endless soccer games, and it's somewhat enjoyable, and it's probably more enjoyable than sitting down to write something.
Is it? It's more enjoyable than pushing the rock up the hill.
Yeah, I don't actually like writing much.
Why?
I feel I'm going to fail each time I do it. I guess I just, each sentence is, there's too much of an ordeal of choice around each sentence. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
And there's no ordeal of choice around the fact that you have a daughter and a son, right? You just, that's it. It's what you were given and you made and you...
And yet you're no less bound to fail in that
absolutely,
endeavor too.
Absolutely right.
Do you cast yourself with, do you stake your claim with any certain living novelist now and say, I'm with her or him and I'm not with him or her? Earlier in your career, you had a tendency to write a little bit more in that vein as a critic, you know, about hysterical realism or whatever it was. I'm for this tendency. I'm not with that tendency.
Yeah.
To some degree.
I think I still... I don't think my taste has changed. My desire to prosecute wars has changed a bit. A militancy has gone. And I'm interested in opening up areas of literature to readers at the moment. But I don't think my taste has changed. I'm still reasonably hostile to fantasy and the fantastic, although I'm really working hard to you know, I'm doing my best. But I'm reasonably hostile to that and always have been. Even as a kid, I was never a kid who really liked comics and stuff like that.
George Martin is not your thing.
It's not my thing.
Yeah.
I'm reasonably hostile to the thing I dubbed hysterical realism years and years ago, and I don't like.
Maybe you should define it.
So a certain kind of this is very tendentious, but I describe it as a certain kind of somewhat unsubtle comedy in which the fiction is semaphoring to the reader that comic and zany and wild events are taking place.
So this exemplified by what novels or writers?
So the books I was writing about when I put the boot in for hysterical realism were Zadie Smith's White Teeth, though that was a review of White Teeth, and it was also a very positive review of what I liked about White Teeth, which is obvious to any reader. Tremendous energy, a comic exuberance that you don't want to diminish, but whose tendencies I wanted, as a critic, I wanted to change a little bit, I guess. Salman Rushdie's The Ground Beneath Her Feet.
The rock and roll novel.
The rock and roll novel. David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest. Pynchon's Mason and Dixon. And parts of DeLillo's Underworld. Not, I think, the great last 150 pages where he's sort of revisiting his childhood in the Bronx. But again, some of this is about, I think, just talking personally, some of this for me is I really like subtlety in fiction. So you know what I'm talking about. Everyone who's ever read a page of David Foster Wallace knows that there's a kind of level of genius there which is not to be gainsaid.
That you acknowledge.
Absolutely. I teach at Harvard brief interviews with hideous men each year because it's a book I admire. But when Wallace is being an ironist, he tends to underline all his ironies, right? I mean, he literally italicizes them or he footnotes them. It seems to me that if you're going to be ironic, you should be subtle about your irony, because that's a sort of a definition of irony, right?
You're saying it's too cartoonish for you.
Yeah, I like hidden irony rather than blatant irony.
You used a great phrase, prosecuting wars, and I'll let all the listeners into a little secret. When you made the jump from the New Republic to the New Yorker, your editor at the New Republic, Leon Wieseltier, basically said, he was quite disappointed, let's say, that you were leaving, and I don't blame him, but that you might go soft because somehow the New Yorker is not a place for prosecuting wars. And in fact, you said, I'm not going to go soft. Do you feel that you have a little bit, or is that a matter of age or a matter of publication or something else?
What I'd say is I don't like the language anymore of I won't go soft. I think that was the wrong way to talk about it, and I shouldn't have done in 2007.
What's the better way to put it?
I will expand.
Because it seems to me, and your editor here is Henry Finder, especially lately in the last, at least the last 3 years, very often the project, at least it seems to me, is here's this new thing I knew nothing about, I'm enthusiastic about it, and I want you to know too. That was quite different than what you tended to do certainly 15 years ago.
Yes. So instead of saying in 2007 I won't go soft, I should have said I won't stay in the same trench. I won't stay in the same rut. There was a tendency to repeat. I mean, this is the awful thing about prosecuting wars, is that you tend to fight the same ones.
Not many literary critics have written fiction, at least recently. I mean, Edmund Wilson did. There are others. How do you fit this into your writing life? What role does it play in your writing life, imaginative life?
I think I have to admit that I'm your sort of nightmare critic cliche. So that's to say, I'm one of those critics who has always been writing ghost novels, always wanted to write fiction, much more than I ever wanted to write criticism. feel that the last 30 years has been a peculiar diversion from my ambition. So I'm definitely not in the camp of, you know, critic can't, critic merely teaches, artist does the real thing. I guess when I'm writing fiction, I don't actually turn off the critical monitor either.
Is that a good thing or a problem?
I think it can be a problem. There's this wonderful phrase that V.S. Pritchett used about Ford Madox Ford. He clearly didn't rate Ford quite as high as, you know, Proust or whatever, and said Ford never fell into that determined stupor out of which great work comes.
It's a great phrase.
It's a wonderful phrase. And we all know what he means. There's a certain kind of, you have to put something to sleep. You have to put some sort of monitor to sleep, I think. And there's a romantic version of it, which is, you know, staying up for four nights running and just, you know, living on inspiration. Occasionally, while writing this novel, I felt that I'd put the critical monitor to sleep. And those were the moments when I truly didn't know where I was going. Those are the moments where artists of all kinds talk about, you know, they use these sort of metaphors of transport, of being taken somewhere, of not knowing where they were going, of being told something by their characters. That occasionally happened. But more often than not, for better or worse, I was still the critic. And I've consoled myself that critical ability has its virtues too when you're writing fiction. Obviously enough, all writers are critics in the sense that we all have to edit and improve and chuck stuff out and do all that.
Now, you're across the kitchen table from a novelist every day. Claire Massoud,
yes,
a terrific novelist. So you have two critics, two novelists in the house, and two bodies. You read each other, and what is it like to read your wife's manuscript, and what do you say and what not?
Yeah, it's a perilous activity, I have to say, perilous for the happiness of our household.
How honest are you?
I'm about 80% honest. But of course, I want her to be 100% honest with me.
So you say.
So I say. I'm her first reader when she's finished her manuscript. She was the first reader of Upstate and tremendously helpful, I have to say. I mean, she brought a novelist's eye to it and said, you know, there's a couple of strands here that you've lopped off too soon and they need to be extended right to the end of the book, particularly because it's a short book. It needs to have that sense of being well wrought. She was great. But you have to hold back a little bit.
With shalom bayit, peace
exactly.
in the household.
Exactly.
James, thank you so much for coming by. It's
always
great to see you. James Wood's new book is called Upstate, and he's writing about fiction all the time at The New Yorker, and you can find it, of course, at newyorker.com.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.